Last time I told you that the standard model for the gauge group was SU, so the gauge group for the standard model was SU3. It's 9 o'clock in the morning, for God's sakes. It's SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. And the gauge bosons are associated with the generators of the group, the same number. So there's 8 here, and they're called gluons. There's 3 here. They're called something. I'm going to label them W1, W2, W3. We could call them weak gauge bosons if you want. And this thing, the gauge boson, there's one of them. I'm going to call that the hypercharged gauge boson. And the Higgs doublet we introduced as a field that's a scalar. It's a doublet under the SU2, so it's two component, just like spin a half representations of the SU2 group if you do angular momentum and spin. And so it's got two components, and I'm just going to call those components. It's a name, H plus and H zero. It's a scalar field. Scalar is telling you how it transforms under Lorentz transformations. And so it's a doublet under the SU2. And it's got hypercharge a half. That's the convention. Some things that I tell you are convention, and some things matter. As we step through the class, you'll be able to understand which things are convention and which things matter, that's for sure. So the Lagrangian for the Higgs, if we just look at operators whose couplings don't go like an inverse power of mass, was d mu h. I'm just quickly going over last yesterday's lecture. Minus the potential, which we wrote like this. So V is a number with dimensions of mass. Lambda is a number, a dimensionless number. They're parameters or coupling constants of the theory. And the covariant derivative is just d mu. There's no color. These things have no color. They don't transform under the SU3. So I just add I G2. The gauge bosons for the SU2 group, which are, I'm going to call W mu A. A goes over 1, 2, 3. And the generators for this representation, the spin a half representation, are the Pauli spin matrices. And I divide them by 2. And that's because my convention for generators is that they're normalized like this. And where these label the various generators of either SU2 or SU3. That'll always be the convention. Of course, if I change my generator by a number, that just changes what I mean by the coupling constant by some number. So there's some, you know, this is a normalization convention. But if I quote you a value of this coupling from experiment, it depends on the convention you chose there. And then there's I, the coupling for hypercharge. And I'm going to call the hypercharge gauge boson B mu. And then there's the half here, hypercharge a half. And so if we want to make a gauge transformation acting on this Higgs doublet, what is a gauge transformation? Well, it depends on parameters in the gauge group. So there's 3 parameters, alpha A. A goes over 1, 2, 3 for the SU2. And there's 1 parameter, alpha, for the hypercharge. And I can write this as either minus I, alpha A, sigma A over 2, where the repeated index is summed here and here, and then e to the minus I alpha over 2 for the hypercharge U1 transformation. And so H under a gauge transformation goes to H prime, which is this U of alpha A alpha on H. So that's how it transforms under gauge transformations. The usual SU2 transformation from when you learned about spin, plus this extra U1. And this covariant derivative is introduced for the same reason as in electrodynamics whenever you have a gauge theory. It's because if I take d mu h prime, that's not equal to u d mu h. But if I take d mu h prime, that's equal to u d mu h. And so it's much easier to make up invariants. Like this is clearly invariant under gauge transformations, because I get the u here And then here I get a U. When I take the dagger, it becomes a U dagger. I get U dagger U, which is 1. So this is clearly invariant under gauge transformations because we made it a covariant derivative. That's why you do it. That's why you do it in electromagnetism. That's why we're doing it here. Okay. So you notice I wrote the potential or the interactions that don't involve derivatives in this particular way. I mentioned last time that you can assemble the most general thing in this way, although I did pick a sign here. V is supposed to be real, so V squared is positive, so in fact we'll pick V positive. So I did pick a sign here, and that was a sign was chosen so that the minimum energy configuration, this is the potential term, so we want to minimize the energy, so we should try to find a configuration for H that minimizes the energy. So a configuration that of H that minimizes the energy, for example, is this. So classically, if we just think of classical energy, treat this as a classical problem, you'd say the ground state was this. If you look at the Hamiltonian, you don't want to have this be a function of space and time because there's kinetic terms that you also want to minimize. Actually, it's a little more subtle with the gauge theory, but let's just leave it at that. So this is a constant, and this clearly minimizes the potential energy. It sets it equal to 0. This is positive definite. So classically, this is our ground state configuration. And because of the usual correspondence with quantum mechanics, if we do perturbation theory, at least if there aren't non-perturbative things that overwhelm that, then we'd assign H an expectation value equal to this in the ground state, in the vacuum, in the state with no particles. Yes?
So when we couple this to other matter fields, we are saying which are not static. Is that a consistent choice? Or?
So it's a choice for the ground state. So if you couple it to other things that are not static and they're huge, they overwhelm this, it could be that there's another ground state you have to seek. If they're small, then you can still expand about this and work as this is the starting state. So it's a question about whether they overwhelm things so you can't start by doing perturbation theory about this. But for us, So this is what we'll take as the expectation value of the Higgs in quantum mechanics. Classically, it was the minimum of the potential. We'll take that as the expectation value. But wait. You're already waiting. You're sitting. You're not running. Give me another suitable ground state. Hold on a second. Oh, did I leave all my money in my office? This could be a disaster class. I'll have to throw you chalk. I did. Oh, I left all my money. Oh, well. What'd you say? Yeah, that's right. Here's another one. Here's another one. Help. Which one should we choose? What's going on? I'm confused. That's sort of what happens in physics all the time. But actually, it doesn't matter which one you choose. You can choose any of these. They all will give you the same physics in the end. And the reason for that is, let's say I chose this one. I could always make a gauge transformation, a global one where the alphas don't depend on space-time, to map this one into this one. And the theory is gauge invariant, so it doesn't matter where we start. So the physics will end up the same no matter which we choose. Let me just give you a little example of that. So here's an element of SU2. I'll call it U star. It's a particular element. 0, 1, minus 1, 0. Right, that's an element of SU2. It's got determinant 1. It's a unitary matrix. U dagger U is equal to 1. And if I take U star, this element, and I act on this, what do I get? Well, I get V over root 2, 0. So you can see that these two vacua, they're not really different. They're just related by gauge transformations. You can, and similarly, you can show that all of them can be mapped into this choice. into this choice. So we're going to stick with this choice, sort of a convention, and there aren't any other independent choices. So we started off with a gauge group. The theory, let me leave out the color. We're just talking about that. The theory was invariant under SU2 cross U1. And the question is, after the Higgs gets this expectation value, then the vacuum's not invariant under this full group, so it won't appear manifestly as a symmetry in the physics we do. But we know, to agree with nature, we got to have a U1 unbroken for electromagnetism. Electromagnetism is a U1 gauge theory. There has to be left over a U1 gauge invariance. It can't be that there's no gauge invariance left over after this Higgs expectation value. Well, it could be, and that would tell us this was the wrong theory. But since this course is the standard model, and you don't get called the standard model unless you're successful, you wouldn't be standard, it's obviously going to work that there's some U1 that's not broken by this. So we should find it. We're in search of a U1. We're on a mission from God. See, I mentioned God in class. At Caltech, I get fired for that. But here, they can't fire me. Where's the middle one? A little confused about all of this. Now I've blown it again. Oh well. Okay, we're in search of a U1 that's unbroken, and that'll be charged. So what do I mean by that? I mean I want to have some generator Q of charge, such that when I act on the Higgs vacuum expectation value, I don't change it. That's what I mean by it being unbroken. It's invariant under it. So what could Q be? Should I say that one more time? It's a gauge symmetry. I already told you the gauge symmetry starts off as SU2 cross U1. We're forgetting about color. That's the whole gauge symmetry, so it's got to live inside there. In other words, I got to be able to take a linear combination of some of those generators, which will generate some U1 subgroup of SU2 cross U1, such that it leaves the Higgs invariant, the Higgs expectation value invariant. So what would leave the Higgs expectation value invariant? Well, if Q was 1, 0, 0, 0, for example, then because I put the V over root 2 downstairs, Q on H would annihilate H, and so e to the I alpha on it would be equal to itself. So I got to get Q out, this Q. So it ends up that Q is T3 plus a half Y, because T3, the third generator, that's a half. So this is Pauli spin matrix 3 over 2. So that's a half. Oh, T3 plus Y. Sorry. What do my notes say? Well, my notes are okay. So we found what we call the electromagnetic subgroup. So the group of transformations with this as the generator, this linear combination, it's not spontaneously broken. It still exists as a symmetry even after the Higgs gets its expectation value. The other generators, the other transformations, when they act on the Higgs, they just take it into something else. And so what we say for this, we write it like this. We say SU2 cross U1, and this one's the hypercharge, if you want, is spontaneously broken to a U1, and this one's the U1 of electromagnetism. So we have a U1 left over. There is an unbroken subgroup. In other words, if I take my U of alpha, my SU2 cross U1 transformations on H, they'll give me back H. And this is, you know, the alpha A and the alpha for the... It's the alpha for the U1 of electromagnetism. This is, this U of alpha, let me write it out, is E to the I alpha, this Q here. Oh, I guess my convention was a minus. Unfortunately, that I think differs from Peskin and Schroeder, but sorry about that. Okay, so we got our ground state. The Higgs has an expectation value in the ground state, so, and we know what that is. But the ground state in particle physics, that's the vacuum. That's the state with nothing in it. We got to do more than that. You'll never get tenure if you spend your whole life in the ground state. Actually, you could. If you could find like the exact wave functional for the ground state, you'd be famous. Yeah?
First you define Q as 1 to equilibrium, and then you find Q is equal to half-life.
What was the first way you said I defined it?
I mean, how do you get Q go to
Oh, I wanted this to be the matrix because I knew that this didn't change the vacuum expectation value. We'll see that the normalization is right in a moment, but at least it's proportional to this. So I'm going to define this to be the charge. And the reason I defined this to be the charge was that it satisfied this property, which I showed you, this T3 plus Y. So it is definitely an unbroken U1 subgroup. And we're going to want to identify that with electromagnetism, and we're going to identify Q. You'll see it. It's a conventional charge later on. Yes?
So from the choices of expectation value of H that you wrote up there, it seems that Q only works for a given gauge choice of that, right?
Oh, Q will look different.
Okay, so Q will look different.
But all the physics will end up the same.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, it might be fun if I made you go through the exercise of like, what would happen if I moved it upstairs or downstairs? Let's say the two choices we mentioned. I think what would happen, when I haven't done this exercise actually myself, but I think when I set up the theory, I think if I set it up with V over root 2 downstairs, and I'm going to have in the end what's called an up quark, what's called a down quark with a certain electrolytic charge. If I set it up the other way around, and I found the corresponding Q with an upstairs, I mean, it might be the field I called the up quark in the old version was actually the down quark.
Okay.
But the physics will end up the same.
Okay.
Never gone through that exercise of making a different choice and working through it. But of course, I'm all powerful now, so I could make you go through that exercise. It might be fun.
And also, E to the minus I of Q is a U1 transform.
Right, that's the U. So associated with electromagnetism is a U1 or U1 transformations, like the electron field goes to e to the minus I alpha times the electron field, for example.
And here you use a 2x2 matrix for Q. This is a Q, a U1 transformation.
Yeah, because Q is acting on a doublet here, but it's still just a U1 group, right?
Because it only has.
It only has the one, yeah. So it's still a U1 group, and I just represented it in this funny way because it's acting on the doublet. And basically, the bottom component doesn't transform, so it's neutral. And the upper one has the one here, so it has charge plus one. And so that's why I wrote H last time as H plus H0. These are the charges under this unbroken group. In other words, U of H is equal to E to the minus I alpha H plus, and it's equal to H0, and so we identify the charge as plus 1 for this, and hence this notation, and 0 for that. Okay, so we don't want to stick in the vacuum for all eternity. It'd be like one of those Greek myths if you did something really bad in your life. We don't want to do that. And so we're gonna expand about the vacuum, do fluctuations about the ground state. And so if I do fluctuations about the ground state, I'll have some fluctuation here, which I'll represent by this field. I got my vacuum expectation value here, plus some fluctuation here, H0. And these are fields, so they're functions of space-time. And let's go ahead and see what the Lagrangian looks like in terms of those quantities, the potential in particular. You with me so far, class? Good. So we want to work out the potential. This part, oh, it's way up there. this, that we have V of H. It's lambda over 4. H dagger H minus V squared over 2. So I'm just going to take this representation of H.
That's all squared.
Yeah, good point. I wish I had a quarter to give you for helping me. In my class at Caltech, when the problem of lack of funds, usually I give a person my cell phone, and they can call their mother or their father. But I'm a little nervous about that here. Sorry, I'm going to the bank right after class. Okay, so thank you. Yeah, so we got to plug this in here. And of course, what H dagger H has a term that's V squared over 2. That'll just cancel this, and you'll get some other stuff left over. Can I just write it out at this point? This is pretty straightforward algebra. Okay? Just going to write out what you get. It's in my notes. I did work it all out. Okay, so if you work it all out, you get the following. You get lambda over 4. Let me leave out the spatial dependence here just to write as little as possible. 2, the real part of H naught, they're complex fields. Oh, no, hold on a second. Where's an eraser? Copied the wrong thing. Well, let me leave this. Okay, this is actually right, but I wanted to do the answer all in one step, and so. What you get, just straightforwardly expanding it all out. So when you look at the potential, look at this chalk. Got like epsilonic chalk here. When you look at the potential, there's various types of terms that have different physical interpretations. If you have a term quadratic in the fields, what's the coefficient of that term physically? Scalar field. Let's say a real scalar field. You look at the term that goes like phi squared. Coefficient of that is, and the potential is, right, half the mass squared. And so we could identify the masses of the various fields here. So which one's got mass? So how many fields are there? There's H plus, which is complex. And then there's H0, which is complex. It's got two parts, the imaginary part and the real part of H0. So 4 degrees of freedom. Yes?
What is the H minus? So the small h
minuses. H minus is the complex conjugate of H plus. Sorry. That's sort of the standard thing you do, because its charge is opposite, so you call it H minus. Instead of H plus dagger. Yeah, sorry about that. I can't help but revert to the standard notation, and then I forget that it's not obvious. Okay, so we want to understand the physics that this potential is telling us. Any massive degrees of freedom? Me and my shadow. So I'm either going to sing for you all lecture, or you're going to tell me a massive degree of freedom. Something that's quadratic in a field. What field has a quadratic term? Is this quadratic? No, this is cubic. It's a real part of H, and they've got two of these. This is quartic. This is quadratic. So real H naught will correspond to some massive degree of freedom, some massive particle. It will be the Higgs boson, the thing they just discovered at the LHC with all the fuss. See, I got my LHC shirt because we just found the Higgs boson in the Standard Model. This class is so well planned. Okay, how about the other ones? They're all massless, right? There's no masters for the rest. Hell's bells. Where's all the rest of these? Where's this massless charged particle in the world? Oh, no. Doesn't look so good, does it? Time to panic. But luckily, people worked this out a long time ago, so I already know the answer. If I didn't already know the answer, it would probably take me a while to figure it out, especially since they're probably going to win the Nobel Prize for figuring this out if they live long enough. So we got to figure out what's going on. What's going on? And remember, these transformations we talked about at the beginning, the gauge transformations, the gauge part has to do with the fact that the parameters in the gauge group are allowed to be functions of space-time. Right? Not just constant numbers, alpha A, like when you do group theory as a mathematician, but functions of space-time. Actually, I wouldn't even know how a mathematician does group theory. Could barely pass math. Don't know any math. Makes me nervous, actually, because I'm supposed to. But anyway, let's go on. So we got to try to understand this. Well, if I make a gauge transformation on this vacuum expectation value here, I'm going to have a neck problem after this lecture. It's all the way up there. If I make a gauge transformation, if it's not in the U1 subgroup, it'll take that configuration to another one of the Higgs field. And that new configuration can be one that depends on space-time. And so some of the degrees of freedom in this Higgs field can be just removed by making a gauge transformation. And I'll tell you how you can figure out which ones pretty simply. So what does a gauge transformation do? The potential is independent under gauge transformations. And so when I go from this vacuum, see, I'm moving my hands as if there's something you could. If you make this gauge transformation, you're going to move along in field space in a certain direction. And because the potential is invariant, that direction costs you no potential energy. And so if you move away from the vacuum along one of these symmetry directions, it'll correspond to a massless degree of freedom because it costs no potential energy to excite the field in that direction, guaranteed by the symmetries. So there's a famous example that you do when you do field theory, which is the Mexican hat potential. So you have a complex field, and this is the real part of phi, and this is the imaginary part of phi out of the board. So you rotate this around, you get something that looks like a Mexican hat, rather high brim, infinitely high brim, but nonetheless we call it a Mexican hat. And if you move along this direction, along the bottom, corresponds to a massless degree of freedom because it causes you no potential energy to excite those directions. So these massless degrees of freedom, the H plus and its complex conjugate, and the imaginary part of H zero, they correspond to the directions that are spontaneously broken. The three broken generators correspond to these three degrees of freedom. There's two in H plus because it's complex, H plus, H minus, MH zero. They correspond to the broken generators and they can just be gauged away. We can make a gauge transformation to remove them with space-time dependent alphas. And so they're not physical. They do go somewhere in the end, you'll see in a moment. But we're gonna go to a gauge, it's called unitary gauge, where they're not there. And so we're going to represent H in unitary gauge. So we made a gauge choice to remove them by just 0, V over root 2 plus the real part of H0. So that, now we're cooking with gas, class. We're on our way to understanding the Standard Model. Huge progress in the last 20 minutes. Huge progress. So, if I want to identify the mass, when I say the mass is the term, so when you write a Lagrangian for a scalar field, usually you write it as a half d mu phi d mu phi minus a half m squared phi squared, right? This is the canonical thing for a real scalar field. You put a half here, you put a half here. You don't have to put the half here. I could have put 67 divided by 32. It's another one of those conventions we always do to make things look nice. But if I put the half here, then the mass is the coefficient here with the half. If I multiply this by 67.5 over 2, the physical mass, you have to have 67, is the coefficient of this with the 67.5 over 2 here. So in order to identify the coefficient of a half the field squared as the mass, I have to make sure my kinetic term is normalized properly. Everybody understand that? So we got to understand, we got to just check that our kinetic term is normalized properly. Where am I? So it's a covariant derivative, so it's true, but let's just focus on the ordinary derivative part. I guess this was. Is this normalized properly? RE stands for the real part. There's no a half. Oh, you can't see here, I forgot. Up we go, board. Up, up and away. It's super board. Wow. It's a pretty high-tech class. Okay, so I'm never going to figure out these boards. But anyways, so I'm going to take the real part of h. The real part of h naught, and I'm going to write that as root 2, as 1 over root 2 times another thing h, and now this little h, which is a real scalar field, has a properly normalized kinetic term. And so with this choice, if I go in terms of h, and I look at the potential v, so let's write, it's easier just to write it out again. With this choice, what have I got? So now I write h like this. H is 0, v plus h all over root 2. And so I have h dagger h minus v squared over 2. And so that's lambda over 8. And then I got v plus h squared minus v squared all squared. So that's lambda over 8. 2hv. Plus h squared. And I've done something wrong.
It's lambda over 16, we think.
Ah, right, it gets squared. Thanks. Who said that?
We collaborated.
Here. Here goes the imaginary quarter.
Split it.
Yeah. Have fun, guys. So what do we have for the mass squared of the Higgs? There'll be, I have to take a half out, there'll be a 1/8, there'll be a lambda, there'll be a v squared, and there'll be a 4. So the Higgs mass squared is lambda over 2 v squared. And experimentally, it's around 125 GeV, 125 times the proton mass, because the particle's been found recently. There are a few holdouts who don't think it's the Higgs boson. They think it's something else. But they're delusional. If we go out for some drinks tonight, I'll name their names, the holdouts. OK, so that's the Higgs boson. But look. The Higgs boson also has a quartic term, an interaction, and a cubic term. all determined by the same coupling lambda and the vacuum expectation value V. The vacuum expectation value V ends up being about 246 GeV. We'll see how physical things depend, other physical things depend on it. From the mass of the Higgs, you just get this product, root of lambda times V. You don't get them separately from that one measurement. Time to do more. Time to do more. Let's see what lives, what physics lives inside. Yes?
You're missing a square on the last line.
You know, I always leave this square out. Have you noticed this pattern? What's up with that? Maybe I have to go see a psychiatrist or something. And then I have to explain to the psychiatrist this problem. That would be a challenge. Okay, what other physics? This is the physics of the potential. The physics of the potential gives us the Higgs mass and the Higgs self-interactions. But there's more physics here that we've written down already in this Lagrangian for the Higgs. There's the physics living in the kinetic terms, because it's a covariant derivative with gauge bosons. So let's think a little bit more about that physics. Well, so when I put in the Higgs field in that term, that Higgs field is this thing here. And so there's terms that don't involve the H at all. They just involve two factors of V and two factors of the gauge bosons. Physically, what is such a mass term? No derivatives. So I'm plugging into this, d mu h dagger, d mu h, and I'm using the form of the covariant derivative. So I'm setting this to zero, the derivative won't matter because this is a constant, and so I'll just pick out the gauge boson part of this. So the term will have no derivatives, it'll have two gauge boson fields, and then a coefficient. Physically, what is such a term? What does it mean physically? It's a mass term. Just like for a scalar, if you have a vector, the term that's quadratic with no derivatives is a mass term, because when you write out the dispersion relation, you know, you vary the Lagrangian to get the equations of motion, it'll look like a mass term in the dispersion relation. So wow, this is a working, maybe. Because what we want to get out of the theory, remember, is a massless photon, and the other ones, the W1, W2, W3, well, sorry. We started off with W1, W2, W3, and B. And what we want to get out is a massless photon and a massive W plus minus and Z. But we're going to get some massive gauge bosons. We're going to get them. We know that. There are some mass terms here. We also know we're going to get a massless photon. It's guaranteed. If you do the calculation and you don't get that, it means you made a mistake, because we showed we didn't break the U1 gauge invariants. And remember, gauge invariants is what makes the photon massless. So that part's going to work. And the part we got to see whether it works now is we're going to get masses for other stuff. And for example, is it going to be the right mass ratio? We measured the masses of the W and Z. Or maybe there's parameters that fix those masses. We're going to just see how it works. So that's what we're going to do right now. We're going to identify what we want to be the W plus minus and Z gauge boson in terms of the fields we started with, W1, W2, W3, and B. Everybody with me? Okay. Well, this is kind of old. So, L gauge boson, how am I doing time-wise? I gotta finish this today, otherwise I'm told they're gonna fire me. It's d mu dagger. And so what am I going to get? Well, this is going to go on the other side, so I'm going to get a V squared over 2 out front. And then I'm going to get the covariant derivative, and because of these squared, the gauge parts, and because these live downstairs, I'm going to get the 2-2 element of this matrix. And remember what it was G2 W mu A sigma A over 2 plus G1 B mu times a half, and this means a half times the identity. Yes?
This looks like the kinetic part of the Lagrangian or the ground state of this vacuum expectation value.
So what I said now was that the full thing we can write like this. So this is the full Higgs field in this unitary gauge. And now, so I should have written plus dot, dot, dot. And we're just focusing on the part that has two V's. There's other parts involving H, too. But we're not looking at those parts. They'll give us some interaction terms. So we're just focusing on this part. Thank you. Should have made that clear. So there's plus dot, 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 which I'm going to stop writing down after this. And we're just focusing on these parts, which are interpreted as master. Everybody got that? Okay, good. And so, I mean, it's not very hard to write this out, right? So, there's a half here, there's a half here. I can bring that out. That makes this an 8. So I get V squared over 8. And then I get G2 W mu 3 plus G1 B. And then I get minus G2 from sigma 3, the third Pauli matrix. And this is the identity, and then I get G2 W mu 1 minus I W mu 2 from the form of the Pauli matrices, sigma 1 and sigma 2. And I have to square this and take the 2-2 element of the square. I'm not writing out the dot dot, so here we go. So I get V squared over 8, and now I gotta write it out, right? So it's row 2 times column 2, so it's this times this. That gives me G2 squared W mu 1, W mu 1, plus W mu 2, W mu 2. And then I gotta do row 2 times, and I get this squared. Oh, well, I moved the minus sign. It doesn't matter because it's square. That's the Thrill of Victory song. At least that's my recollection of it from the wide world of sports when I was a child. I don't know what the Agony of Defeat song is. I'm sort of familiar with the feeling. I don't know what the song is. Okay, so what do we got? These are real scalar fields. These are going to correspond to the charged W bosons. In a moment, I'll show you why. And so what we've got is let me just not say that right now. What we've got are massive Ws. So these are W1 and 2, they have a mass square that ends up being V squared over 4, G2 squared. Oh, shoot. And then it ends up, for a properly normalized kinetic term, you choose the Z field to be G2 W mu 3 minus G1 B mu and mz squared is v squared over 4 g1 squared plus g2 squared. So remember, like when we had the Higgs field, we had to make sure things were properly normalized. The kinetic term had the proper normalization to read off the mass. So I haven't written up for you at all what the kinetic terms are for the gauge bosons. What you do is just like in electromagnetism, you have to introduce a field strength tensor with two indices, anti-symmetric, and you put usually put in minus a quarter the square of that, which we do. And when you expand that out, you get terms with derivatives, and you can see if it's a standard kinetic term or not. And it is a standard kinetic term with these normalizations. And the photon, so here's one field that's got a mass. Am I on the bottom? Nope. The photon will be the field that's orthogonal to this. And it has no mass term. Okay, so I got notes all over the place. We made a lot of problems. Yeah?
So how do you know that the photon is a field orthogonal to that?
Well, there is. So once you identify a field, you'll want to pick an orthogonal basis. And so the other one has no mass term. And so it's the one orthogonal to it. You choose the orthogonal basis so you have two kinetic terms that aren't coupled to each other. And the other field. So you start off with some kinetic fields and kinetic terms in terms of the original field. And if you make an orthogonal transformation on them, the kinetic terms will stay standard form. So I want to identify terms that are orthogonal in this mass eigenstate basis so that the kinetic terms end up properly normalized and orthogonal, so we can identify that degree of freedom. But I have kinetic terms that go like d mu w, d mu w, the half, plus d mu b plus a half. And then I make some orthogonal transformations to define new fields. They'll stay in the same form. And I want to... And so so that's why I picked the orthogonal combination, because that way the kinetic terms will stay proper. Okay, so I have W1 and W2. They're real scalar fields. You haven't heard about W1 and W2. No one talks about W1 and W2. You go home, ask your parents, what's W1 and W2? They won't know what the hell you're talking about. And so they might come back with, do you mean W plus and W minus, the charged W bosons? So I got to tell you where the charged W bosons live. So let me tell you that. That should, what am I doing time-wise? So we might be able to do a little more today. Don't fear, class. So let's say we look at this object, W mu A. Sigma A over 2. And usually when you think about something and you're not sure how it's going, the thing to do in physics is simplify the problem as much as you can. So you have to think about as few things as possible, but still keep the essence of what you're trying to understand. So we're trying to figure out the charge of something. That has to do with the gauge transformations on it. We might as well just look at global ones, because you can read off the charge from that as well. So let's think of global SU2 cross U1 transformations. This gauge field here, how does it transform? Well, this thing goes into U. U inverse. And U, this is a U for an electromagnetic gauge transformation. And so it's e to the minus I alpha sigma 3 over 2. This is just T3. Well, these have no hypercharge. They just transform under the SU2 part of the group. So this is how electromagnetism acts on the W bosons. You write T3 plus Y, but Y is irrelevant here. It just goes through and eats itself in the inverse. You with me? And T3 is sigma 3 over 2. So this matrix here is e to the minus I alpha over 2, 0, 0, e to the I alpha over 2. We know it explicitly. WA sigma A is equal to W3, W1 minus I, W2, W1. I'm leaving out the subscript mu just to write that as little as possible. So now it's multiplying 2 by 2 matrices. That's something we can all do. If it was 3 by 3, okay, I'd say only 20% of us can do it. And I wouldn't be in that 20%. But for 2 by 2, we can do it. So we multiply out the matrices, and what do we get for this? We get W3 minus W3. There's more to it than this. We get W1 minus I, W2, e to the minus I alpha, W1 plus I, W2, e to the I alpha. Yes?
Why we're transforming that quantity?
Because we want to understand what the charge it are of the W bosons, W1, W2, W1 and W2.
And the charge tells, or is given by how
it, yeah, how it transforms under gauge transformations. So if it went, if it goes to e to the minus I alpha 5 times the field, then its charge is 5. If it goes e to the minus I alpha times minus 3, the charge is minus 3. That's how you identify the charge. That's what it has to do with, how it transforms under gauge transformations. So W3 doesn't transform. It came back in the same form. And so W3 corresponds to some neutral field. It's partly in the photon and partly in the Z boson. And the things that have charge, W1 minus I, W2 over root 2, will be W plus. And the one with that destroys a W plus boson, a charge plus 1. Will be the W minus. One is the adjoint of the other. One's the dagger of the other, of course. So there, we've identified the charge W boson degrees of freedom. So now, we've got all the degrees of freedom. We know what's massive. We know what isn't massive. It's all good. Boy, we got a lot of physics out of this thing so far. There's more physics in it. Tell me something else you could get out of it.
Sorry, could you mind
Well, so the way I've set everything up, if you identify the charge, you identify a charge, you transform it under electromagnetic gauge transformations. And if it transforms like e to the minus is my convention instead of plus, but e to the minus I alpha, alpha is the parameter, times Q, times the field, then that Q is the charge of the field under electromagnetism. That's the unbroken subgroup, and particles with different charge are distinguished by, the charge really is the generator of that group, and they're distinguished by how they transform.
Why did you define W plus and W minus?
Oh, so here they are. Why did I put the root 2 is the only thing? And that was, again, to give me a, to keep the kinetic terms normalized in the standard way.
Why those linear combinations?
Oh, because it's this combination that transforms with the phase. If I took W1, it wouldn't transform. It's just an overall phase. And things with definite charge transform with an overall phase. If you have something that's a superposition of two different charges, it won't transform with an overall phase. Sorry, should have made that clear.
Can you say again how you define Z, or why you define Z and A over there?
Okay, so when I worked out what the mass term was, where'd it go? Yeah. When I worked out what the mass term is, you can see that this combination has a mass.
Yeah.
And then I just divide it by the square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared to make it properly normalized. So that's one field that has a mass. But we started with two fields. So there's 2 degrees of freedom. There's some other field that's massless. So I got to have my kinetic term still written as a half this field squared plus a half the other field squared. Before it started off as a half this one squared with derivatives and a half this one squared. So it's got to be the orthogonal combination. That's the massless one in order to keep the kinetic terms properly normalized. Right? I want to identify the massive and massless degrees of freedom, and I want their kinetic terms not to have any cross-coupling, not to have a d mu a, d mu z. If I don't pick the orthogonal combination, there'll be a cross-term.
And what does this have to do with being massive or massless?
Massive or massless, that these are the mass terms, the only terms that have mass for the boson. So here, this field is massive. So this becomes, this is just written as a mass term for Z. There is no mass term for A. So it is a massless degree of freedom.
Oh, okay.
Everybody, this is the key to the standard model. Your whole future as a member of the human race depends on understanding this. I don't want to minimize the importance. So ask me more questions if you don't have it. If you're not sure if you have it, so you don't want to ask me a question right now, think about it and come back and ask me a question. You got to understand this. Your life will be incomplete without it. Plus, it's not so hard. You know, it's not like you have to solve some enormously complicated differential equation. It's just you got to understand the physics in it.
And, not want to say that there's a W3 that transforms with charge zero?
The W3 does transform with charge zero, right? It has charge zero. It's not a mass eigenstate. It's a linear combination of the photon and the Z, but it does have charge zero. It's a linear combination of two charge zero states. And the Z has charge zero. Okay. We got a few minutes left. Answer my last question. In this kinetic term, there's more physics. What other physics is there? Well, how I got these mass terms was I wrote the Higgs field as, I just replaced it by the VeV over 2, leaving out the Higgs field part of it. So if I put the Higgs back in, what type of terms would I get? I'd get terms involving the Higgs and the W plus minus and Z-gauge bosons. I'd get interaction terms. Those terms would allow certain physical processes. Let me draw some pictures for physical processes that come from reading off those terms in the Lagrangian and making the Feynman rules. Where should I put it, class? I'm wandering aimlessly. We'll go back to here. This is so old. Basically, I just want to press these buttons and watch this go up and down. Well, what type of terms might we get? Well, when we expand it all out, there's going to be a term with one Higgs field and two W bosons. And there's going to be a term with one Higgs field and two Z bosons. Now, it ends up the W and Z bosons weigh around 80 and 90 GeV, respectively. And so the Higgs cannot decay to them. You can't conserve energy, have it decay to them. So these Feynman diagrams don't give you Higgs decay. But if the Higgs was heavier, if we lived in a world where the Higgs had weighed 200 GeV, then these simple Feynman diagrams would have given you the rates for Higgs to W plus W minus and Higgs to ZZ. You could calculate those rates, and they would be the dominant decay rates of the Higgs boson if we had lived in that world. These couplings still play an important role. For example, this W boson could materialize to an electron and an antineutrino, and the Higgs can decay through this, and it is one of the ways that the Higgs decays. So it is important. And you just read off these vertices, the Feynman rule, you read off the Lagrangian and from those kinetic terms where you allow for one Higgs in the kinetic term. And you can read this off from the same type of the d mu h dagger d mu h term in the Lagrangian. Is that clear to everybody? Well, you'll get some practice in that at some point. So
that these decays can't happen because of energy conservation, but they still influence physics.
Because this could be a virtual particle rematerializing as an electron, and then it's off shell, and so this process does occur. Also, the production of the Higgs, there's one way to produce it, it's not the most important, where you take quark from one proton, quark from the other proton, this is a W, and then the Higgs comes off here. This is one of the production mechanisms of the Higgs called associated production that people look at. It's not the dominant one, but it is an important one. Okay, so next class, we're finally, yes.
You said a W plus boson decays into electron and neutrino.
Positron and neutrino. Thank you. Okay. So next, we got to add a lot of stuff, right? So far we got the Higgs and the gauge bosons. There's more to the standard model than the Higgs and the gauge boson. So next class, we're going to add all the rest of the stuff, all the rest of the matter, the quarks, the leptons, and start working out their physics of those particles.